Hi, and welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Jazz, I've seen you online call yourself a reformed people pleaser. And I think this is something that an awful lot of people suffer with. So I wanted to pick your brains. How did you stop being a people pleaser? And more importantly, how did it change your life?
Oh my gosh, totally. People pleasing comes from a variety of areas. It could come from a feeling that you're not worthy or not good enough, which is a should story or an oughts and shoulds, my mate calls it. From when you're growing up, you know, you were constantly told your brother's a smart one, not you, you're creative or whatever, but you take on these layered stories and kind of your skin grows over the top and then you don't even know it's there anymore. You just have these stories that you hold to be true. Like I always say, most of us upgrade our phones, but we don't upgrade the stories and we're living with old stories the whole time. So that feeling of I've got to please people can come from because I'm not good enough. And that's what I started looking at. What's the because? Rather than my narrative was, well, I've got to do this. Well, I can't say that. Well, I must do that. I started adding because to the end. And then suddenly it didn't make sense. Well, I've got to make 800 fairy cakes for the school fete because if I don't, I won't be a good mum. No, that doesn't make sense. Because if I don't, other people will think I can't bake. Well, that's true. What do I care? Because if I don't, well, no one dies. So actually, do you know what I mean? And so I had to actually, it's a jazz hack. I had to work it through. I just added the word because to the end and see what came. And at the beginning it was, I have to do this because if I don't, people will think this of me. But you know, at the end of the day, there are thousands of stories about who I am and what I do. And I don't know, maybe 20% of them are accurate, but I can't concern myself with what everyone thinks of me. I walk into a room, they see, well, first of all, they're like, oh my God, Beyonce's turned up, but they see a woman or they see someone who's brown or they make all these assumptions, working class, my accent, they make all these assumptions. I can't be all of those things for those people. So I'm going to do me. And if you don't like it, other sausages are available. And I started taking on this. If I truly want to please people, then moving my boundaries all the time so that I have nothing left, I'm on the floor and I feel resentful, isn't ultimately pleasing anyone. It's because I end up being annoyed with them as well. So I really had to take the emotion out of it and try, which is hard for me because I'm a total like feeler. But if I take the emotion out of it and try and make logical sense of stuff, and there is no sense. There is no, same with imposter syndrome. Oh, I don't think I can do that. You don't think you can get on stage and speak after 3,000 keynotes and 3 Speaker of the Year awards. You don't think you're very good. I mean, it just doesn't make evidence and data outweighs your own thoughts and feelings. And I had to choose fact over feeling when it came to people pleasing. And the fact was I was running myself into the ground, feeling worse about myself, living by fear of what people might think of me if I did something different. And when I actually started not saying no, because I couldn't do it, but I would say things that I had stock phrases like, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. Or actually that doesn't work for me. And that's a powerful one. Oh, that doesn't work for me. People in response to that go, oh, okay, right. Well, how about this? They will literally compromise for you. I was constantly amazed that people would make space for me because my idea was, no, I'm not good enough. People let me do it. So it's been a journey, but it's, and I still feel it. It's not that I don't feel it. And I'm not some like, you know, megalomaniac. I don't care how you feel. I don't want to be that person, but I turn the volume down on it because that if you're a people pleaser, you are letting fear drive your bus. Fear of what people think, say, do about you drive your bus. And fear is not your driver. That's like giving a 6-year-old access to a double decker and they don't even know the way to Tesco's and you're like, have at it. It's a 3-ton killing machine. You do not put a child in charge of that. So I'm just constantly trying to add the because on the end. And then I know when it doesn't make sense, I'm like, right, let's make a logical decision. Are we going to continue in this vein?
Everything you said there makes absolute perfect sense. But was it an easy process? Was it something that's taken an awful lot of time? And following up from that, once you begin to say, oh, that doesn't work for me, are you almost kind of building up the positive reinforcement that you can do this in small increments?
That's good. That's a good point. I think maybe, but it doesn't work for me, or let me think about it, is another way of me saying, I don't want to do this, but I can't think of a reason right now. I'll come back to you. Because I found it hard to say no. It was so embedded in me saying no. And it wasn't an easy process, but I have tried being in pain. You know, Brené Brown talks about the discomfort of saying the 40 seconds of discomfort of saying no, I don't want to do that, as opposed to the 4 hours of resentment that you feel when you've said yes. So it's weighing up. No, it wasn't easy. And I think I got tired of being tired, especially when I only had myself to blame. So I would get cross at people for asking me to do something, and I'd say yes to it, and then I'd have to do it, and I'd be annoyed, but I'd be annoyed at them. Well, what? How am I annoyed at that? They asked, if you didn't want to do it, you couldn't do it. You should have said at the time. So it took a lot of resentment directed at other people and then towards myself before I changed. But also it's going through stages, because I would say things like, oh my God, why did you say yes? You're so stupid. Why did you keep saying yes? Just because you want everyone to like you. Some people don't like you. Get used to it. But that is not how I speak to my children. That is not how I speak to my friends. That's the special little critical voice I say for myself. You're fat, you're old, you're going grey. My little pep talk that I give myself in the morning. So I started trying to change that as well into, you know, what would be great is if you could stay in alignment with your values and live in alignment with your values. And every time you say yes to something that makes you cross a boundary of yourself, you are living outside your own integrity. And how long can you do that, Jazz? Because your whole job, your whole life, everything you stand for requires you to live inside your own integrity. So you're giving a lot away. And then the other thing I did is I had a list on my computer. This is in the early days. I had a list on my computer of all the things that are important to me, like 5 things important to me. And when people asked me to do something, I looked at that list. Is it on the list? Is it in the line? So it had like my vision and my mission. And at the time I was a literacy consultant. It was like making sure kids leave primary school with the ability to read, write and spell. I mean, most of them leave with the ability to mummify a dead Egyptian should the need ever arise, but they struggle with literacy. So that was one of my big missions. And then I put things on that, like Will Smith was on the list, right? I like Will Smith. My husband, he was under Will Smith, but he was on the list. My kids, they were probably a bit higher. You know, these things were on the list. So I would consult it. I'd look at it and go, yep, that's got nothing to do with anything on this list that I've said is important to me. So it's an easy no, because it doesn't. So it's not me making the decision. It's the list. It's not my rules. It's the list. So I would try and find another way. And gradually I got down to, you know what? I'm Marmite, and you're going to either like me and lick me or leave me. And I'm happy with all of those because I can't function outside what I can do. And I've got so much more done and made so much more impact personally and had professionally gone through the roof since I have started not trying to please people. I literally have got a t-shirt that says other sausages are available. I refer you to my breasts. That's, you know, it's like, but you have to get there, and it's a journey. And I don't think I've finished. I think I still find myself like, why am I in? Why have I said I'm going to do that? I don't even want to. Don't even want to do that. Why I don't want to wear sew 14 waistcoats for the nativity? Why do I want to do that for? So I try and have the discomfort rather than the regret. And it is, most of the time it works.
Following on from being a people pleaser, much more generally, I think a lot of people struggle, maybe women especially, with putting themselves first. Mm-hmm. There's always someone else that needs their attention. It might not be directly pleasing people. It's just putting others, the needs of others, in front of you.
Yeah.
How on earth does somebody begin to break that negative, debilitating cycle of never putting themselves first? Because I would imagine by trying to care for everyone apart from yourself, you can't really do the job that you're trying to do.
And it's noble, isn't it? It's noble. I was doing a Love Morecambe Day a few years ago in Morecambe. It brought together lots of people from different communities. And I asked people to stand and face each other and to pay decide who's A and B and pay a compliment. Say something nice about someone's face. Just say something nice about their face. And they both had a go. And then I said, who felt uncomfortable doing that? Hands up. Who wanted to punch their partner? Yeah. Who felt uncomfortable receiving a compliment? Lots of people felt okay giving it, but receiving it was hard. And I'm like, and I spoke to this one woman and she was saying, well, I'm a giver. That's who I am. That's what I do. That's my identity. And I'm like, great. But you are supposed to be serving from your saucer and you're serving from your cup. So you're going to have nothing left. What kind of strategy is that? If you, and I've did a little video on this. I love tea. I don't drink, but tea is my thing. So if you're filling up a cup, right, you're supposed to, on a saucer, you're supposed to fill it up so that the tea comes out the saucer. That's what you serve some, because you keep your cup overflowing, filled up and overflowing. So you can constantly give and serve. But the moment you give someone your cup and they down it like it's a flipping drinking competition, you got nothing left. So what are you going to give then? I ask people to put work, family and friends, and their own mental health in order of priority, because they're the three most important things. Put them in order. And people often put family and friends first and then health second, or health first, family friend. Work's always last. And it always makes me think, even with family and friends first, who's going to look after them if you're lying on the floor because you haven't been looking after you? It's just not a great strategy, is it? But often people put family and friends or health first, but it's not that. When I actually say, all right, I'm coming to your house for 3 months, I'm going to live with you and follow you around, and every time you say, do, think or feel anything to do with these three options, I'm going to put a mark on a sheet. And when you're in the shower, it should go under health. But if you're thinking about a meeting, it's going under work. And when you're having dinner with your kids, if it should be under family and friends. But if your mind's on emails, it's going under work. And after 3 months, does my chart say what you've just said? It doesn't. So it's just about owning what we say and what we do are out of whack. We need to get it in alignment. And this whole idea, it is a noble cause, wanting to prioritize people and put them first. Fantastic. But if you haven't got what you need in the tank, it's a ridiculous strategy, and you have a bad plan. You have a bad plan, which is going to finish you off. And there is nothing noble about you lying on the floor, gasping for breath, because you have failed to prioritize your most valuable results. So it's not noble. It's not, and it's not selfish to put yourself first. It's not selfish. On a plane, put your own oxygen mask on and then pick your favorite child practically. Because if you're choking to death, you can't help anything. So if you, I kind of see it as don't, when people say, I feel so selfish, I'm going to put myself first. Selfish island, population one. I'm like, it's not selfish. Don't focus on that. Focus on, I am going to fight for the highest good of the people that I love and live with and serve. And to do that, I need to go and watch Netflix. I'm out. In fact, I'd use language when I'd crochet. Look, here's my crochet. I crochet because I've got ADHD, no surprise there. And I do stuff that is meditative to sort of slow my brain down. So I sit and crochet, and sometimes I'll put Netflix on at the same time. I'm not really watching it, but it's the noise. And my kids will come up and I'll go, oh, can you see mummy's healing? I'm doing two things at the minute. This is like meditative healing for me. Is anyone dying? And also, you have a father. And I literally show them, this is not the time for you to interrupt me because I am filling myself up, because I want them to have that same. I want them to have that attitude. I don't want them to learn the hard way like I did.
So for people really struggling to put themselves first, where do they start? Is it something you can do entirely by yourself, or do you need to recruit your partner to say, look, I need help with this, I need help with that? What is the actual advice for somebody who really does need to put themselves first but just doesn't know where to begin, Jazz?
Yeah, it's hard because we're so embedded with our habits. But I would say doing it on your own, I don't know anyone that can successfully just say, you know what I'm going to do? Stop smoking and stop drinking and stop everything that's bad for me. We'd all be fit as a butcher's dog, wouldn't we, if you could just do it on your own. I would say surround yourselves with people who are on the same journey as you. Like on Facebook, I've got a group called the Impact Lounge, and it was meant to be just a few people wanting to have an impact. There's 2,000 people in there all sharing, this is what I've done today, and everyone jumps in and goes, yeah, great win. It's just a space where we've got 2.5 rules of the Impact Lounge. There's 2.5 rules in our family, 2.5 rules in our business. First rule is be kind. You do not know what people are going through. Be kind to yourself, because don't put ridiculous expectations on yourself. Just be kind. The second rule is, it's a bit rude, don't be a dick. But the thing is, if you can't be kind, don't make it any worse, right? Just don't make it any worse if you can't be kind. And rule 2.5 is, if in doubt, refer to rule 2. And that's what I literally live by. So I have these little mantras that are easy for me to do. Tiny marginal gains, tiny steps. That's where the whole 10% braver method came from. So I have little things that I'll do that allow me to actually start that journey and get some momentum. So putting myself first, started off with, I'm going to find 1 minute a day where I'm going to sit, do nothing and breathe. Just for 1 minute a day. And if you can't find 1 minute to breathe, you are already in trouble. So you found this podcast at the right time. But 1 minute. And then it's like, oh, 1 minute's actually not that difficult. Maybe I could do 1 minute 20, maybe. And I just sort of built up little things. Another thing with me was like going to the gym. It was always such a big thing. Got to get your gym kit. So I do things like, right, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to get my gym kit ready. And then that's it. That's all I'm aiming to do. So I just got it ready and left it in the corner. Then I'm going to put the gym kit in the car and that's it. So I spent a week driving around with my shorts and vest and pants in my car. I'm going to drive to the gym. I'm not going to go in, but I'm actually going to drive. So I'm literally retraining myself on the things that I've said are impossible by chunking it down and doing a tiny bit. So I would drive to the gym and then just come back and think I was looking for a medal. I just drove to the gym. Does anyone know? Because I know that next week, all that will be a habit and then I'll be able to drive to the gym and actually go in. And then it was going in and like getting changed, but then not doing anything. I mean, it sounds stupid, but I had to retrain myself to do small steps well and make them a habit because it was too big to just all at once start prioritizing myself. It was too big. There was too much. I don't deserve it. People like me don't do things like this. It was too much to fight all at once. So I chunked it down into tiny, tiny steps. Like I would do if I was teaching a toddler how to make fish fingers. And then each step was one that I mastered and made part of my day, made easy. So the next step went on from there.
You mentioned social media there in a positive Facebook group for like-minded people. Mm. What's your view generally on social media, Jazz? Because there's so much attention and research done on what it's doing to young kids. Yeah. But what about people like us? Because you can very easily see people living this dream life and you feel like imposter syndrome or you're not living up to being the dream partner, you know, father, whatever it might be. Do people need to really curate what they see on social media, be proactive in getting rid of things that are making them happy?
Yeah, I mean, I do worry about young people with social media, but I feel like, you know, Gen A, just it's their life and they know that is their world. And there are positives to not trusting anything you see because they're so TikTok, you know, aware. And there's Gen Zs and millennials. Millennials, I guess, weren't. They didn't have it right at the beginning, but Gen Zs certainly have grown up in that world. I often think about Gen X, like inept 50-year-olds, the ones who text with one finger, you know, not being disparatory. I've been known to do that, but I'm a bit better on my thumbs. I often think about people who, you know, are looking to connect or looking to share. And it's so easy to open up Insta and then suddenly start seeing other things and start doing that whole comparisonitis. Your life's different to mine. Comparing your backstage with everyone else's front stage. Oh, my life's so bad. Oh, I'm a terrible person. I'm a terrible parent. And it just forms the same. It's the news all over again. Like, I don't watch the news. I don't like being manipulated. So I don't, because it's like, here's another terrible, terrifying story. Here's another one. It's all bad. I'm like, when was the last time it wasn't bad? Oh, it never was. Because it's so easy to sell fear. And social media trades on fear, but the fear of not enoughness. And so we have this narrative of thinking we're not enough in it. And in a way, it keeps us busy, doesn't it? Keeps us busy worrying about something, stops us from, I don't know, coming up with a cure for cancer or working out why our toxic relationship is damaging us and we should actually leave. It stops us from dealing with the actual questions that can allow us to be the human we were designed to be and not the human that social media says we have to be. But we get so busy and so drawn into it that our lives get sucked away. And it's actually satisfying for that moment as well. And what I've done is I give myself a time limit. I'm like, you can have 10 minutes a day to mindlessly scroll through Instagram. Go do it. But afterwards, I want you to make a note of how you feel. just collect some data and evidence. Make a note. And what I found doing that is that I've moved away, much as I love them, from videos of, you know, children falling over, which is, I mean, they do make a big fuss, and animals doing stupid things. I actually watch, guess what, videos about crochet because it's incredibly relaxing. So now I'm ticking my meditative box. So, but I've had to learn that because I just noted how much time I was spending feeling crap. after it. And he's like, I don't want to do that. I've tried being depressed. I've tried feeling awful. It sucks. I don't want to do that. So I want to get away from it. So I do worry about people who are using social media as a form of connection. You know, all that data is being collected and used for us and against us. And now Apple have just put out their M1 and up is AI enabled. Apple AI. But so everything talks to each other. So, AI is going to change the way we live and work, right? And then kill us all. So we should enjoy it now. But I just feel like the more content we put into social media, the more it has to look at algorithms and put things at us to keep us. It's a really like enclosed, toxic, lifeblood sucking relationship. You might as well just have a baby, to be honest. Because they suck the lifeblood out of you. They don't give you anything back. They might smile about 12 weeks in, but, you know, it's just, they're just take. And it feels a bit like that.
How worried are you that we're spending so much of our lives online? Because I grew up as a young journalist and it was all about getting out and meeting people and building contacts and that human connection. And obviously since lockdown, we're doing this over the internet now rather than meeting face to face. How concerned are you, Jazz, by not just young people, everyone spending more and more time communicating through text, not picking up the phone, not seeing people? Is that going to have a profound impact on our mental health and our well-being?
Just from a point of view of a screen. So everything I do, I always used to get annoyed when people say, look at that mum walking with her kid on her phone. Yeah, I'm not playing bloody Angry Birds. I'm making dentist appointments. I'm booking in people's for play dates. I'm making a list for the shopping that I have to do later. Do you know what I mean? It's like my phone is not a phone. It's my second brain. It's my brain is for creativity. That phone is for storage. So everything goes on there. So what's annoying about that is that in the evening when I finish working, looking at this screen, then if I want to crochet something, I've got to look at a tutorial or get a pattern. Everything is stored in my Notion. All the patterns are there. All the wool I've got. So everything I do, I'm learning to play the cello. Oh, look, my cello teacher's online. Oh, I've got to sort out food. Oh, it's all. So I'm drawn back to the screen again and again and again. And frequently I can't function unless I have some sort of device with everything on there. And I find that frustrating because I don't want to be staring, just the action of staring at a screen the whole time. We were told our eyes would go square if we watched too much telly, and that was when we were allowed to watch an hour a day. So now when I'm living at the cinema constantly, but that aside, the ease of being able to get something, like I have got a terrible Amazon addiction. And I don't want to use Amazon. I want to use eBay, but it takes longer. And I'm so like, oh, you can get it by 1 o'clock the next day. Like I'm going to need those sticky hooks by 1 o'clock. They're going to sit on the table for 4 weeks before I get around to sticking them up. So why do I need them in the next 48 hours? But, you know, you kind of, everything this urgent and it's straight away and you can get it and we should do it. If you write a letter, you have to wait 3 days. You know, I used to go to the library and request a book and then wait 2 weeks for some idiot in Scotland to finish reading it so I get my projects finished by then. And I'm not saying that's a good thing, but it taught you ways round, because what the internet does is make everything easy. And what I like to do is inconvenience myself, because all the great ideas and great inventions and great solutions have come out of solving a problem. And if you take all the problems away, you don't need to connect. You don't need to know how to use a phone. You don't need to make a phone call. You could just be an anonymous person shouting at people on Twitter. If you take away the inconvenience, what's left is ease, and no one thinks and no one engages. Do you remember that? Wall-E, it was a Disney film. I've got 3 kids, so all my quotes come from Disney. In Wall-E, the robot was the star, but the humans had to leave Earth because Earth was ruined, and they were living in this ship orbiting somewhere. And they were all in these massive chairs and on wheels or hover chairs because they couldn't walk anymore. But the chairs had internet, phone, drinks, food, robots running around. I'm avoiding that. That's what I'm trying to avoid. When we're all there, I'll still be running around going, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to walk to the shop, and everyone will think I'm a weirdo. I love weird. But everything is becoming so easy, and it feels like inconveniencing yourself might be the way to freedom.
I want to talk to you about compliments, because I think an awful lot of people, and I don't know whether this is a British thing, are quite bad at taking compliments. And again, I want to give you a very quick example of me when someone I remember an occasion somebody paid me a compliment for something I'd done at work, and I immediately kind of downplayed it. And their reaction, they were a lot more senior than me. It was kind of like, why did you do that? Yeah. That just makes me think you're not proud of yourself or that anyone could have done it. Well, I think this is a really common problem. Why do people immediately go down the self-deprecation route? And do you think it is harmful, you know, to how you're perceived by others?
It's lying. That's what it is. It's lying. So I am so dead set against this. It's actually I'm driven by dissatisfaction, not by some altruistic, let's make the world a happy place. I'm dissatisfied that people aren't living to their full potential and live, you know, and the impact that has on others. Compliments is a big one. And I think partly it's because people have this thing in the back, especially women have this thing in the back of head. Well, it's arrogant, isn't it? It's bragging. We don't want to do that. It's not bragging if it's the truth. Then it's not, it's just the truth. It's just a fact. But if you are saying grandiose statements of things that you haven't done, then that's not helpful, because people are going to rely on that, and then you can't do it. And we're back into the people pleasing, I can't do it right thing. So I think people feel, well, you know, I really think that people choose. I think it is a choice, and because this gives us the autonomy to choose something else. They choose to be embarrassed, or they choose to be uncomfortable, rather than choosing to acknowledge and accept. So my big thing is, if someone says to you, I like your top, you go, oh, it's only Primark. And it's like, all right, sorry for assuming you took care of yourself and clothed your body in appropriate fabrics. Oh, what are you saying? It's only Primark. You know, I like your top. Oh, it's only $4.99. Oh, I've had it years. Oh, no, I don't need your life history, right? I'm just complimenting you on your colour choices. So what I do is work on people. When people do it to me, I say, I like this. And I do this a lot. When I'm at airports, spend a lot of time speaking and traveling, I'll just walk up to someone and go, love your cardie, and walk off. Because it helps them. It breaks the tone. It helps them to get used to going, oh, well, thank you, because it's a stranger. So one of the things I ask people to do is, when someone says something nice to you, look them in the eye or around the eyes, in the face, general area, smile and say thank you. And that's it. That's all you have to do. Smile. Thank you. That's it. But it is so hard. I've seen people trying to give compliments, and people will literally, body language, oh no, oh no, no. The other thing is, when people describe themselves using the word just, oh, I'm just a technician. I'm just a TA. Oh, I'm just a mum. When people do that, I say, oh, because endearing, oh, would you mind, can I invite you to say that again without using the word just? Because it's we're laying. Every time we say something, you say it once, we hear it twice, it goes in, it's embedded. So we need to unlayer all of that stuff. We need to stop layering on the belief that you're not worthy, and start standing. I mean, if you weren't worthy, right, or if you're not good enough, or you're not deserving of compliments, the government will be doing experiments on you, because you'd be the only person on the planet who wasn't. It doesn't make sense that you're not good enough. Why are you so special that you're not good enough? Everyone deserves kindness, but not you. Why do you think you're so special? You're not unique. Everybody is, we're all unique. We all got our own skills and talents. So I think it's kind of reversing that idea of, if someone says something nice to me, I shouldn't accept it because that means I'm big-headed. If someone says something nice to me, it's like them offering me a bag of crisps. And if I went, oh no, I'm implying that they've got germs and I don't want to share food with them, which is actually quite unkind. But if I went, oh, thank you very much, then that's an appropriate response. So it's the same as someone offering you a pickled onion monster munch. Just say thank you. Just, even if you don't have to eat it, just say thank you. It's a nice act. So I do think it's damaging. And I'm on a one woman campaign to stop people from denying the truth about themselves. And one more thing. Well, I was at a school. I was doing some coaching of the SLT, the senior leadership. The head's taking me around, takes me to the deputy's room. The deputy's teaching, and she's got a girl skirt. So she's on the Isle of Wight, and her class, she had like all the girls have blonde hair and blue eyes, and they're all hanging around her in like a skirt formation and trying to show her their work. And she walks to the door and her girl skirt follows her. And the head says, oh, and this woman's amazing. What she can do with the class, the work she gets out of these kids, absolutely incredible. I'm so glad she's in my school. And the deputy went, oh, no, no, well, no, no, no. So afterwards, but in the coaching, I said to her, why did you do that? And she said, well, you just do, don't you? I mean, it's British, isn't it? It's just, you just do. And I said, okay, so I get that. But you had around you a group of 6-year-old girls. And what you showed them is that when someone says something about you that is true, and complimentary, you have to call them out as a liar and deny it. And they are watching you, recording your every notion and your way of being like a video camera. So I'm just interested in whether you're happy with the message you're sending out. She burst into tears. She burst into tears. And it was this feeling, this realization of, oh gosh, that's the impact I'm having. Because we all want to have a great impact, but we don't all look at what that looks like. We put ourselves to a point where we're diminishing ourselves, making ourselves so small that we don't matter anymore. And it's just not right. It's not right.
A lot of people struggle to take compliments, but I think an awful lot of people also struggle to give them. That is a problem, Jazz, you don't have. And I've witnessed firsthand your compliments, because just before New Year, I got an email out of the blue from you saying our conversation was one of the favorite moments you'd had last year. You really enjoyed it. You'd love to do it again. And it was, I know, an email that might have only taken you 30 seconds to write, but let you in on a secret. I was having a pretty tough time around the new year. My dad had been in hospital for a month. My little boy had been off nursery ill. Your message, I felt like I was walking on air for a week, because I was like, do you know what? I've got this. I can do this. And I think the ability, the power of your words there was absolutely what I needed at that time. And, you know, you didn't know that until now.
No.
But I'm going to get to a question, I promise you, rather than just a thank you.
I'm glad you told me. Thank you for sharing.
But my question is, how can I? We've all got so much love and positivity in us, but I think, again, might be a British thing. We're quite bad at letting it out. One thing, taking compliments. How can we start giving genuine compliments? Because I think the power of it is it's enough to make the world go round. If enough of us start doing it, good things will happen. Where do we begin?
I've got a formula for this. This is one of my tools, because this was not something that I did. I do it now because I've gone on this journey and I see things. But what I realized is that I would notice something. It starts with noticing something, like, oh, I like your hair. Your hair looks nice. Her hair looks nice. Notice. Then you describe it. Oh, her hair looks nice. You put an adjective around what it is. Then you jump to judgment. Oh, I bet she's on her way out for a night out. I bet she, do you know what I mean? So we see something. Oh, your displays look nice. Oh, I bet she's trying to get brownie points. Oh, that's a good piece of writing you've done. Oh God, it's going to be better than mine. We add judgment. So what I do is I notice and I describe and I stop. I don't add any judgment. So I notice something. Our conversation was so good. And I'm at the end of the year and I'm thinking, what went well this year? What am I good? Oh, you know what? I love speaking to Joe. I'm going to tell him. So I noticed I love Joe. I love speaking to you. It was great. I'm going to describe how it made me feel. It was absolutely. I'm not looking to judge it. I'm not looking to. So, you know, you must be good at this and do you want? I'm not asking for anything. I'm like, I'm available if you want me. But I just stop after that. And it's like swapping judgment for curiosity, swapping fear for curiosity, but just leaving it in an open space. So I would say I don't pay compliments. I would say I speak facts. So because I often say things that aren't as complimentary as well, but I mean, you know, other sausages are available. If you don't like it, you don't have to lick me. But I would say that I notice something and then I describe it. And somebody said to me the other day, you've got truth Tourette's, because I just say a statement that is true. I'm like, I don't know if that's a thing, but yeah. But also the other day, a couple of years ago at IKEA, I was waiting in the till and this woman had loads of little things and she suddenly looked at me and went, well, I'm going as fast as I can. And I was like, I didn't say anything. Turns out I did say something. I said what I was thinking, which was, you're very slow. And I said it out loud. You're very slow. That's a fact. She was very slow. But I've just gotten so used to sort of that circular notice, describe, stop, notice, describe, stop. If it's a nice thing that you're noticing describing, then feel free to share. But if you're noticing and describing something critical, is it helpful? And that's my other thing. Feedback should be kind, specific, and helpful. Kind on its own doesn't mean anything. It's just, you know, I like your hair. Oh, great. What do I do about that? Specific, that people get good at that. I don't like the way, when you do this, when you do that, people nitpick. Specific's good, but if it hasn't got kindness with it, and helpful, it's actually got to move me on somewhere or make me feel like I can do something or bring me back to a point of excellence. If it's not all three of those, that's the highest form of compliments or feedback or fact. They're kind, they're specific, and they're helpful. That's what I taught when I was teaching five-year-olds. They seem to be able to do it. But a grown-ass man should be able to do it as well.
So why are we so bad at giving compliments generally then? Is it a fear of being exposed? Is it a fear of self-preservation, or they're going to be better than me, they're going to do X, Y, and Z? Why do you think so many of us really struggle to offer meaningful compliments?
I think men have it hard, because if you give a compliment to a woman, are you inappropriate? Are you coming on to her? So I think that's tricky, that there's that kind of feeling. I think when it comes to even just like trying to compliment someone, I was talking yesterday about saying, when I showed a photo of my family when I was a kid, and there's me and five others, and they're all white and I'm the brown one. And I always ask people what they notice. They notice love and connection. And I'm like, I asked, what else do you know? What else? Nothing. And I always think that some people say, oh, I didn't like to say that you're brown. The thing that people did notice I was brown, and it was people on the street who would shout very hurtful and awful things. So I grew up, because no one who was fighting for my highest good in school ever said anything positive about being caramel top, I grew up thinking it was bad and it was wrong and I was dirty. Do you know what I mean? So the lack of truth was very difficult there. And I try and see compliments as truth. So when people feel, oh, I don't want to give a compliment, it's either because they don't want to be rejected, they don't want people to think they're trying to, you know, smother up to them, they don't want to, they don't want to look as if they are not in authentic in any way. And all these are, again, it's that thing of adding because. I can't say that because. Why can't you say that? What's the actual reason? And also, we want to be part of a community, and we want to bring up the underdog. But when the underdog starts getting a bit higher, then we start taking them down. Read the papers. If someone, we want to, that's very British, to encourage people until they're doing well and then rip them a new one, because we want, there's a sweet spot. Like when an avocado is ripe, 11:05 on a Tuesday, there's only a few minutes. There's only a short space of time where we're okay. And if you're above that or below that, something has to be done. So I think compliments in our heads, compliments put us at a disadvantage, where in reality, the truth will set you free. So actually saying something that is true, not a compliment, just true, is really helpful. And it comes, appraisals is a great thing. Everyone goes in worrying about what they're going to say. I hope it's a nice one. And hope isn't a strategy. If you go in and say, hey, look, I know where I'm doing well, examples, and I know where I've got space to improve, examples. If you can add something to that, let's get stuck in. But if you're just going to tell me what I know, we could probably both be doing more important things. I'm not hoping. I'm expecting things to go well, and I'm laying a foundation for it. So compliments are connected to truth and how comfortable we are with the truth and with sharing it. And I'm not saying, you know, radical honesty will get you into trouble. Telling someone that their bum looks big, telling your mum you hate her roast potatoes, it will make you more popular. So I'm not saying you should just, you know, I know everyone tells white lies. I guess we do. But I just think there's times when being able to speak into someone's life with a bit of truth is probably one of the greatest gifts we can give each other as humans.
There'll be a lot of people watching this, Jazz, who are used at work to receiving a lot of criticism, but not much praise. You've got extensive experience of working with senior leadership teams. Everyone will know of had that experience of a bad boss.
Yeah.
So I was really hoping you could give some advice on what can you do? How can you get the best out of a bad boss situation? You know, I'm thinking someone who's very quick to judge, quick to criticize, never praises, takes credit for your work. This will resonate with an awful lot of people. Where can you begin in that situation?
Yeah, this is really hard. And the answer is not hiring Prison Mick, who will charge us 50 quid to kneecap people. That's never the answer, even if you've thought about it. And I've got to say, joking aside, there's a time to leave. There's a time to take yourself elsewhere because you are not being appreciated and staying there is going to steal from you. There is a time for that. But I often say, like, this happens a lot in education. There are some toxic leadership teams, toxic leaders that, I mean, it's everywhere, but in education, you'd expect it to be better. But I always say to people, try a different school before you give up on teaching, because it might be this community, this culture, but it's not everywhere. So try a different company before you leave entirely. Try a different profession before you say, I can't work for anyone anymore. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. But if you are in a situation where you're under toxic leadership and you have the resources to navigate that and to present an alternative, a more compelling story, if you don't have the resources, you need to get the resources first, take care of yourself first. But if you do, then there are lots of ways that you can work within that situation. And one of them, like when I used to live in London, right, I used to get the tube everywhere. The tube is a nightmare, especially if you've got a fantastic bottom like me, because the amount of times that people would feel the need to touch my fantastic bottom just to check that it's not, you know, a hologram to feel it. So what I would do when someone did that, because that's trying to make me feel bad and me feel shame and me feel small. So what I do is say to everyone else, I don't think it's appropriate for someone to touch my bottom in this situation. Do you think it's appropriate? It's awful, isn't it? Yeah, I don't think it's right. Can I ask you why you did that? So what I'm doing is called force teaming. I'm bringing everyone else in. So the eyes have turned, the shame as a spot, shame spotlight, shame spray has come off me and onto them, because now all of us think you're an idiot. So that's a survival technique as the woman that I use. There are lots more. I've got loads of tube tips for women that I use on shame, but I do the same with leadership. So without trying to make, I'm trying to call my leader up, but not call them out, because no one responds to being called out. So by calling them up, I will say in front of them with someone else, to someone else. And so there's other people there. You know, what's great is when we are given the space and time to do this. And I know you've done this before, insert name of toxic leader in the thing. What doesn't help that is when we're being constantly criticized, because all of us feel that we want to show up and do our best. But when that criticism comes first, everyone kind of turns off a little bit, and then it takes a bit more to get up, and your job's harder because you're having to build us up again. But because we want to do the best we can for you, because we want to make you look good, this is how we function at our... Do you see what I mean? I'm bringing everyone in and saying, here's what you've got to gain from not being so critical. There's a lot for you to gain. And if you, and people are critical leaders, because it's fear again. They're scared. They're like, do this, do this. I met one guy and he was saying, you know what? She leaves work every single day, bang on 4 o'clock, every single day. I'm here till 6, but she's leaving. I'm like, is she doing the work? Is she doing what she needs to do? Because if she does, why are you bothered? You should be going to her and going, oh my gosh, tell me how you do it so you can leave at 4 so I can do the same. What are you moaning about? But it's that thing that often people criticize, or bosses criticize women, because they're fearful. They're fearful that you're not going to do it, that they don't delegate, they do it themselves because they can't trust anyone because they're so scared that it won't go well. So if you can speak into that fear, if you can meet that fear, they soften. They often soften. Some people are just like, you know, you get promoted through ineptitude. You know, you're not good at this. Let's move you on to a promotion. So you can often end up with somebody was telling me yesterday about a CEO who'd said there was a football team. There were some girls in it at a school. And the CEO has said, oh, we need our best players in this team. So you need to get rid of those three girls and put some boys in. We need our best players there. And the guy was like, sorry, can you hear yourself? No, they are the best players. That's why they're in the team. And the CEO's like, no, we can't have that. And this person left, because I'm like, if you can't work with someone, if you're coming up against that. But in the end, that person then moved on. The CEO then moved on, because it's never just you. It's never just you who is being bullied by that boss. It's never just you. It's always other people. So be part of the gang. Be part of the team. Force team, bring other people on, have conversations that are not, take it out of the darkness and into light. Because while you let someone say these things to you, or even when they're shouting you down in public, I am still fighting for their highest good. So if you are my boss and you turn on me, and I always praise in public and, you know, criticize in private, that's what I try and do. I don't always get it right, but if I'm going to say something, I take someone aside and have a conversation with them to call them up. If I'm going to say something good, I'll say it in front of everyone so that it's always there. But if someone is calling you out in an environment where everyone else is there and no one is brave enough to say anything else, then your integrity could step in into that place and say, you know what? I want to do the best. So I'm going to try and take this criticism, however harsh, and pull out the bits that will help me improve. But what I know is that you in the past have given me feedback that has been constructive and has been positive, and I have shone in that space. And I'd love for you to do that again, because when you do that, you lift all of us. So all I'm doing all the time is like gently encouraging that leader to be less fearful and more integral, more strength driven, more focused on what they're actually trying to achieve. But as I start this, there is a time to leave. There is a time not to put up with that. And I don't tell many people this, but I'll give you this. I was pregnant. Oh, I started at a new school teaching, independent school, and I got pregnant. I started in September, got pregnant in November. So I had to go and tell my new boss, who brought me on to change the culture, that I was pregnant. So I sat down with her. Oh, I was really scared. And I sat down with her and I said, I'm so sorry. Here I am apologizing over my unborn child. I'm so sorry, but I have to tell you that I'm pregnant. My intention, the baby's not due till the summer. My intention is to work all through to the end of the year and to come back after maternity leave. But, you know, this is where we are. And she said to me, well, that's unfortunate because you've just started. And I said, yeah, I'm so sorry. She said, yes, it's not, you know, I wouldn't have taken you on if I'd known this was going to happen. And I'm like, okay, I think that's illegal, but okay, sorry. And then she said, would you consider having an abortion? And I said, I don't know. I'll have to ask Ed. Because I couldn't say in that space, F you. No, I will not. I couldn't say it. So I was so, I accepted that toxic behavior to the extent where I just said, and I left and I felt awful and I felt so much shame. And I was so, I was taken, I stole her shame. She should have been ashamed of that. But I stole that shame for her and wore it myself like a dress. And then at the, and I stayed, but it was a difficult pregnancy because, you know, obviously she was my boss. It was a hard, and then in the end, I think I left like a week before the end of term and I never went back. But what I promised myself is that I will never take someone else's shame away from them. If someone is behaving badly, I'm not going to make it all right for them. I'm going to call them up. And that's what I try and do.
And that's an absolutely horrendous situation. And I can only imagine how you must have felt in that situation. But why do you think that, and again, moving away from that specific example, just why do you think some people act like that? Because fear is at the center of so many abhorrent decisions. If we're being charitable, is her fear of having to find a replacement behind it? I mean, it's inexcusable, but I'm just trying to get a sense of why you see such toxic attributes in leadership, because it can't just be fear. There must just be arseholes as well, right?
There probably is, but you're not born an arsehole, are you? That's not, you don't come out. That's a learned behavior, and that's learned from the situations and the nurture and the experiences you have. So as a society, we can complain when someone is being an idiot and someone's being rude, but we also have to take a collective responsibility for creating that ability for a person to grow into that. And I know that it feels a bit harsh and it feels a bit, you know, but it's like when there's a big, I don't know, when there's a shooting or when there's a, and we all like, oh, he's a bad un. People aren't born like, not as many as do it. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are born with conditions, but so it's not my fault that she's an idiot. Unfortunately, I'm not responsible for her happiness, so I don't have to take it on board. But it's people are ultimately trying to protect themselves. And so fear very quickly, because they haven't slowed their thinking down to think about their journey. Fear very quickly turns to its fear of loss. What's it going to look like for me? I'm going to have to find something else. That's inconvenient for me. You've hurt me. You've done it on purpose. Why are you doing this? I'm the boss of you. Pack it in. And that happens so quickly that people don't even see the connection between those things. But it's fear rising the whole time. And yeah, some people have been hurt to the extent where, you know, they hurt other people. Hurt people hurt people. It's not rocket science. So some people are trying to grab and keep and keep, you know, build something around them that makes them safe. And in an attempt to do that, they take other people down as if in any way someone else being on the floor makes you taller. I don't know how that works, but people have that as a way of being. But often it's because that's what they had. That's what they received. Their boss was toxic too. We've all got bosses that we'd have worked for without being paid because they built us up. And we've all got bosses who, you know, we ran for the hills because they were just so bad. But if someone is behaving in a way that is, I mean, you know, is it the Moonies? Who dresses in orange? In San Francisco in the 60s, monks, some sort of monks dressed in orange. I don't know who they are. Hare Krishna. They used to give out, they would try and collect money, right, for their church or whatever they have. They try and collect money at airports and bus stations, and people were like, no. And then what they worked out is if they give someone a flower, it's forced teaming. I give you a flower and you go, oh, thank you. And then I say, would you like to make a donation? Well, reciprocity dictates, the rules of reciprocity dictate that, well, I'm a dick if I don't. So you give them a bit of a penny. And obviously we're all aware of that now and it doesn't work. But it was a real kind of, we understand as humans that being part of a community is important. Even as introverts, we need people around us. So if we do something that takes us out of that community, we're in danger of being ostracized. So if we don't feel that we belong, if we fear that we might, then we start lording it over other people, try and steal some of their belonging so that we can feel safer and better. And it's not like, I'm not saying let everybody off. Feels like I'm, you know, like, well, I suppose I am a namby-pamby snowflake, but I, with an edge, but I feel like it's, we're not living in some fairy tale of four legs good, two legs bad. Little Red Riding Hood's good and the wolf is bad. That's not how life is. And every time we try and lay that on the top, we're missing the way we could actually change things. So some people are idiots, but they're usually idiots for a reason. And what I try and look at is, here's the front. What's behind the front? What's driving that? Because if you can speak into that, you can change. And I want change more than I want to be right. I want to be right a lot. Ask Ed, he will tell you. But I want change more, marginally. So that means I have to inconvenience myself sometimes in order, I have an inside voice and an outside voice in order to get that change.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.